All right, so this is with apologies to Antonio Banderas, because this is pretty much me doing Puss in Boots. I'm sorry, you look so familiar. Haven't we met before somewhere? Only in my dreams. This is Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I'm your host, Dan Benamore. Today we're talking about the 2002 film Femme Fatale. The show stars, this movie stars Rebecca Romijn, Antonio Banderas, Peter Coyote, and a bunch of French people. Brian De Palma wrote and directed the film. On a budget of $35 million, the film grossed $16.8 million worldwide, and it holds a 49% on Rotten Tomatoes. My guest this week is Joe Aliberti. Joe is a writer, director, and producer of over 20 films, several of which have been represented at Sundance, Tribeca, South by Southwest, and many more festivals. He's just finished production on the Emil Hirsch, Kate Bosworth film, The Immaculate Room, and is currently finishing a script for his next film. Joe is the one who suggested we do this movie, which immediately means I have a lot of questions for Joe. Welcome, Joe.
Yes, this is a very strange film to choose, but it's not talked about enough. I think, especially in terms of Brian De Palma's oeuvre, it's not talked about as much as it should be, because it's the quintessential Brian De Palma film.
Yes. So before we started, Joe, you were saying how De Palma famously doesn't do commentaries and stuff. And so I wanted to ask you, have you seen the documentary De Palma?
Sure. I've seen it many times. I really enjoy it. I enjoy, going through his filmography from, his Godardian, Greetings, Hi Mom films, up through Sisters, through Carrie, the Blowout, all the way up until, Mission to Mars and Redacted and whatever he's making now, Domino or whatever, Passion. And last year in the pandemic, my fiance and I did a Brian De Palma deep dive.
Wow.
I'm a big fan of his. I always have been. And she, I think she'd maybe seen, Carrie or whatever, but sure. She hadn't really seen much. So we started with Sisters, and we went basically film by film all the way up to Raising Kane, Mission Impossible kind of thing. We actually didn't get to Femme Fatale. So that's why I'm happy that we're doing this, because I rewatched it this week. I think it's on Amazon Prime free. And I think that there's a Warner Archive DVD that you can get, or Blu-ray, that is out now. But
Joe, I think it's going to work out with your fiance, man.
Yeah. I mean, I put her through the ringer. I mean,
if she's willing to sit and watch all the De Palma movies with you.
Yeah, all of them, dude. Like Obsession, The Fury, Dress to Kill, Body Double, Raising Kane. She just went through all of them.
You guys are going to be married for 60 years. This is great.
Yeah, yeah. But we enjoyed it. I think she enjoyed it. I mean, his films are so, they mentioned this in the Noah Baumbach, Jake Paltrow doc. His films have this symphonic feel to them, and it's true. They are so virtuosic in a sense. Even a lot of them are so implausible or whatever. But and that's kind of what I love about Femme Fatale, is that it just leans into the implausibility so much. So obviously, up until the ending, where it's that it's implausible. But it's just I find with this film, I think I first saw this film as a 13 or 14 year old, on Cinemax, after the softcore porn aired, it's really, really late night. And I was just wow, what the fuck is this? And I just sort of followed it, it would be on, and I'd follow it through my teens and, sort of watched it a little bit more and every here and there. But I hadn't seen it since, maybe for 10 years since I watched it, last night. And really, I think that it holds up. I find it so enjoyable, because it is such a this great summation of his career and his style of this, this pure cinema.
Yeah, I want to just career. Just as an aside for the audience, if anyone hasn't seen that De Palma documentary, it's so funny that you mentioned that you've seen it multiple times, because I've also seen it multiple times, and then watching Femme Fatale, I was like, man, maybe I'm gonna go watch the De Palma documentary. And I went to watch it, and you have you can either rent it for $4 or buy it for $15. And yeah. I legitimately considered buying it, because I'm like, I know I'm gonna watch this another 20 times.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people who listen to this also listen to the Ringer shows, the rewatchables and the Big Picture. And Sean Fantasy on those shows, he's actually mentioned this as well, that he'll just throw on the De Palma documentary at night as a way to like chill out.
Oh, get out. Yeah, that's great. I think that's probably the you know, several of the times I've watched it has probably been just to like go to bed or just to listen to something in the background. It has this, you know, rewatchability aspect to it where it's just like, you just, you know, as filmmakers ourselves, there's just something wonderful about listening to him speak about his movies. Unfortunately for us, you know, or maybe not unfortunately, because we'll talk about it, but Femme Fatale is kind of skipped over in that film. Not skipped over, but like there's not much.
Yeah, I mean, I have so many questions. Yeah, there is a lot to wonder about. So let's just get into it. So the movie starts. I mean, again, you mentioned how this is De Palma to his De Palmiest, and it begins with the climax of the movie Double Indemnity, which is obviously a very famous film noir. And he pulls back to reveal Rebecca Romijn is laying in bed watching it. She's got a sheet strategically draped across her body. And to me, it was like De Palma being like, listen, you know the deal. You know who I am. You've seen my other movies. Yeah. I'm just doing the same thing, but like I'm doing it even crazier than usual.
Yeah.
What do you think he's going for with that opening shot?
Oh, I think there's something incredibly meta about that opening shot, about, you know, about watching movies and about how we watch movies and how, you know, and then obviously you're going into the Cannes Film Festival right after. I mean, that's basically where they are, but it's like, you're getting ready to watch a movie and he's telling you that you're about to watch a movie. So he's sort of preparing you. He's sort of telling you, you know, throw everything away, suspend your disbelief. This is going to be a movie and it's going to be a wild ride. And then you get, and she's like sort of studying Barbara Stanwyck in a way, you know, she's like this like icy femme fatale that both of them are. Obviously, you know, she is, you know, the updated, evolved, more erotic Barbara Stanwyck. But I think that he's just trying to get us, he's trying to pull us in. He's trying to pull us in by saying, we're in a movie now, you're watching a movie and shit's gonna get crazy.
Yeah.
And you are gonna be okay with it because I'm telling you to be okay with it.
Yeah, so we meet mercenary thief Lar, and it's not Laura, it's not Laurie, her name is Lar.
Lar, yes.
She's part of a team executing a diamond heist at the Cannes Film Festival. The diamonds are located on a gold ensemble. It's like a gold shirt dress thing worn by this model, Veronica, who is accompanying a real-life director to the premiere of his film. At one point, they show a French security guard drinking an Orangina, which is very authentic. I spent a lot of time in France as a kid.
Yeah.
Lar seduces Veronica in order to obtain the diamonds, during which her accomplices Black Tie and Racine provide support. There's a lot of great Mission Impossible style, kind of like running around.
Yeah.
I think that now people don't kind of like forgot that De Palma really was responsible for launching Mission Impossible.
Right.
And when I say she seduces Veronica, literally she is a complete stranger, walks up to this person, whispers something in her ear for 2 seconds. And this lady who's wearing this like $2.5 million outfit's like, okay, cool. Let's go to the bathroom.
Cool. I'll meet you in the bathroom. Yeah. It's completely implausible. It would not happen. And I think as we continue to talk about this movie, we'll see that De Palma is dropping clues and dropping little things that tell us this isn't what you think it is, you know? But that's all part of it. That's all part of the fun of this movie. And then obviously, you know, she's wearing this, like she's wearing this dress that with all these diamonds in it, which is the most De Palma thing ever. Like let's do a jewel heist, but instead of like going to a bank, it's just on someone at a movie premiere.
Well, yeah. And then, so they go to the bathroom and like the whole plan is while Rebecca Romijn is hooking up with this woman and kissing her and stuff, she is removing her jewel dress thing and dropping the individual pieces of it to the ground, where her accomplice is like comically crouched next to the bathroom stall. And he's like sliding replicas underneath.
Right, right.
Did you laugh out loud as this was going on?
Of course. I mean, not only that, but like the guy eating pancakes or waffles or something and spilling maple syrup on the keys and then having to go wash the key and bringing the big keychain back. But it's like, you know, that makes sense. It's like, oh, there's like 40 keys on this chain. So he's not going to notice that just one of them is missing. And he just pockets it and gives it the keys back. And then there's like this, also this other thing with like this flashlight kind of laser serpentine thing that goes through and like stretches all the way to this control board in a basement that like blacks out the theater. Do you remember that?
Yeah, and then a cat starts like smacking it.
Yeah. It's just, it's incredible. It's hard not to laugh, but it's also hard not to appreciate like the complete virtuosic, you know.
Yeah, I think this is a movie that you're going to have one of two reactions to as a viewer. Either you're going to just start laughing, but like laughing in a fun way, like you're sort of like enjoying how ridiculous it is, or you're just going to check out. I mean, it's one or the other. There's no middle ground. The heist is botched and Laura ends up double crossing her accomplices and escaping to Paris with the diamonds. In Paris, a series of complicated events causes Laura to be mistaken for a missing Parisian woman named Lily. The people who think that they are her real parents take her in. She kind of goes to take a bath in the tub at Lily's house. The real Lily returns and commits suicide while Lar watches. And then Lar steals her identity, leaves the country to go to the United States. The girl that she is mistaken for looks exactly like her, not sort of like her, not a, you know, a resemblance. It's the same it's just the same actress. It's just a picture.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just more like if you thought the heist was implausible, setup is the most implausible thing ever.
Yeah. 7 years later, Lar in her identity as Lily resurfaces in Paris as the wife of Bruce Watts, the new American ambassador to France, played by Peter Coyote, whom she romances in part by like talking about her fake identities, the little girl dying. Like she uses that as a sympathy card. Again, the movie has a really dark sense of humor. After arriving in France, a Spanish paparazzo named Nicolas Bardot, played by Antonio Banderas, takes her picture. And again, the setup for Banderas. So he gets a phone call from like his photographer agent.
Yes.
First of all,
like really like in the mafia or something.
And then he says, if you can get a picture of the American ambassador's wife, I can get five figures for this picture. Which, why would anyone care about a picture of the American? It's the equivalent of, like in the United States, if someone's like, hey, if you can get me a picture of like Mitch McConnell's wife, I'll give you $100,000. Like nobody would care.
Yeah, dude. It's like, you can get me five figures. It's like, oh, really? Is that like, what is that? It's like, you know, it's not like a life-changing amount of money. It's just like, and yes, why would anybody need a picture of this? I guess the reason is because no one's seen her because she's trying to lay low, right? She's trying to not be photographed because she's on the lam in a sense from these, from her partners that she's double crossed.
Yeah,
so it's a fun way for De Palma to thrust the story forward, but it's also, again, just doesn't make that much sense.
I think that my kind of big take on this is that I think De Palma is a brilliant director who is as good as his material, and in this case, I believe it's De Palma wrote the script, and it's one of those things that I've come across this. I'm sure you have. Sometimes you get directors who are capable writers, but they're not really writers, right? Like they're more directors. And writers obsess about this stuff, like the plausibility of the thing with the photographer guy calling him. Like we would sit and think about it for a week and like it has to make sense. If it doesn't make sense, then whatever. De Palma's like, listen, we're just moving forward.
And that's what I think that's what he sort of inherited from Hitchcock, is like this sense of this. You know, he obviously is more of a director than he is a writer. I think he's a great writer. I've read several of his scripts and they are very good. But he it's not really so much about what's plausible to him. I think, and he mentions this in the doc, is that he finds visual ideas and works from there, as opposed to most writers who find a character and work out.
Yes.
You know, he's just get like, he finds these big set pieces in his head and he's like, you know, I think if I match this with this, this is going to be a fun, interesting visual thing that I can do.
It's a little bit like Ridley Scott.
And it just goes with it. Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Ridley Scott is has talked about how he is a frustrated writer, that he, you know, basically is not really a writer. He's more of a visual guy. And then he needs the writer to like come up with the story, but he thinks in visual terms. So I think De Palma is almost like, if Ridley Scott wrote a script, it'd be like a pretty good script. It just wouldn't be a writer's script. And I think that's the De Palma situation. De Palma's like, if I have an idea, I'm just going to fucking write it and go make it. And I'm not going to wait around. And I think that's the result, for better or worse, is his stuff, you know?
Yeah, and just to add to that, I mean, in you know, relative to his career, right? I mean, this is a movie that came out after a massive flop, right? Mission to Mars. And he's done this before in his career where he'll make a massive flop. You know, in 1990 he makes Bonfire of the Vanities, right? I mean, there's a book about it, you know, the Devil's Candy, right?
Great book, by the way.
Great book. And it's this huge, massive flop with huge stars, huge studio movie. And then what does he do afterwards? He goes and he makes a very small thriller. He goes and makes Raising Cain. And he does the same thing here. And he's done this over, like, throughout his career, where he'll make a big studio film. It won't really be really his cup of tea or the audience's cup of tea. And then he goes back to these genre films that he's like perfected. And this is just another case of that. But I think with this one, I think he really lets go, because it's like, it's not in the US, it's not in Hollywood. It's backed by French money and they love him and they let him do what he wants. And he really goes for it. And I think he really knocks it out of the park.
Let's get into the French thing. So just quickly moving through the plot. So this picture that Banderas takes is displayed around Paris. So Black Tie, who has just been released from prison, and hilariously is wearing the exact same outfit from the heist.
Oh, right.
As if no time has passed. Time was suspended. Nobody like took this outfit off. Anyway, so basically he sees the picture, so they know where she is. So now she's in trouble. Her ex-accomplices are going to go after her. She pretends to be suicidal to get Banderas to like sympathize with her. Then as he's like kind of comforting her, she pretends to be undressing for a bath. They hook up. This kind of brings me to my next question. Is Brian De Palma the horniest mainstream film director? And then how does that play into the French stuff?
Well, I you know, he absolutely is. And he's like the climax in the basement is like the hottest scene ever. Like, and he says this all the time, is that he loves photographing women. He loves following women. I mean, he's done it throughout his entire career. And he's gotten a lot of guff for it as well. But he goes for it here. And I think that he can do that in this film because it's probably not backed, you know, in the US. It's not really an American film. It's more of a French film.
Yeah. I mean, in France,
they are.
Yeah. This might be interesting for the audience. So like, I have distinct memories of going to France as a little kid. And you go to the supermarket. I don't know if this has changed since last time I was there, but you're walking to the supermarket, and in America, where you would see, you know, the OK magazine or whatever it is, celebrity magazines on the thing, you still have that in France, but there's just straight up naked pictures of people on the covers. So imagine if it's like People magazine or something, right? But instead of whatever, Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez on the cover, it's like some French equivalent of that, but like somebody is just not wearing a shirt. And like breasts exposed, and you're just like, this isn't the supermarket. And that's just
I was thinking about that too, you know, the beginning of this film with the model who's accompanying the director, you know, who Rebecca Romijn is hooking up with. I mean, her breasts are exposed and she's at a film premiere. You know, I mean, you know, think about the Oscars or, you know, any film festival, even like at Toronto or something, any film festival in North America, it's like, you know, that stuff is not going to fly. That kind of attire is not going to fly. But in France, it's just like, they were like, they didn't even mention it. They were just like, oh, yes.
If you go to the beach in France, it is a pretty common thing that when women sunbathe, they just will remove their top. I mean, it's not considered like socially taboo or unusual. Yeah. So it's a very different culture. It just ironically, it fits in with De Palma, because De Palma is the horniest director.
So
De Palma. we'll get more into that. We got to take a break for our sponsor. We're gonna come back. For anyone who hasn't seen the movie and was just curious and is comfortable with us spoiling it, we're gonna get to the bananas shit that happens at the end of this movie in the back half of the show. We'll be right back. Movies I Love That No One Talks About is brought to you by Virtual Pitch Fest. Virtual Pitch Fest is a trusted industry source that specializes in connecting screenwriters with production companies and representatives. With Virtual Pitch Fest, writers can search through an online database, almost like a dating site, to see what 500 plus participating companies are looking for. They can then send short written pitches on their scripts to chosen companies, with the assurance of a guaranteed response back. That's right. Guaranteed, you get an answer, you get a fair shot. That's a really critical difference with this service compared to some of the other online pitch services for writers. To date, Site Connections have led to 150 plus success stories, including produced films. There's actually a Bruce Willis, Megan Fox movie that was recently produced directly because of Virtual Pitch Fest. Just a writer who, you know, was relatively unknown, went on there, did a pitch. The pitch was picked up by a producer, and then that ended up becoming this movie. There have also been dozens of other script deals, many writers landing representation. If this sounds like something that could be useful to you, check out Virtual Pitch Fest at virtualpitchfest.com. Okay, we are back. So Lar decides to frame Bardot for her own staged kidnapping. So that, you know, maybe I'll post a flow chart or something on the Facebook page of the group, but it's a very complicated plot. Bardot is further manipulated by Lar. She helps clear him of suspicion for the crime that she framed him for. And then he sort of gets involved in the kidnapping. They have a sexual relationship now. The scene that that you mentioned before where we're in a they go to a basement. She like tries to make Banderas jealous.
Yeah.
Then the guy that she performs a lap dance on this guy. That guy then tries to rape her. Banderas assaults him in such a way that he may or may not have killed him. And then they have sex essentially over his corpse. this is just literally me telling you the plot. The pair eventually meet with Bruce for a ransom exchange. However, Bardot has a crisis of conscience at the last moment and sabotages the scheme. Did you notice? Is it just my interpretation? I feel like Banderas is almost like a proxy for the audience where I see him acting, but I almost can sense that he doesn't know what the hell is going on in any given scene. And he's kind of like, I'm just going to act my way through this. Like,
yeah, in a sense. Yeah. I mean, like he, you know, I read something earlier about, you know, this movie in relation to Double Indemnity and how Fred McMurray in that movie thought that he was so ahead of Barbara Stanwyck and that he was like, gonna win in the end. And he had no idea. And I think that Banderas is the same way. I think that he believes that he's sort of getting a step ahead of Lore / Lily, and he's really 10 steps behind. And so are we as an audience until that moment, the climactic reveal of the third act, which I think redeems the whole movie in a sense.
Yeah, well, because here's what's interesting about it. So along the way, we keep getting these little weird touches. So for example, in the bar, Banderas goes to buy cigarettes. The bartender is this little French guy who was an accomplice of the heist in the opening scene of the movie, which obviously is weird, right? That,
yeah.
And so there's a photo collage that is shown in the back. It's like against the wall of an apartment.
In that split screen moment, right? That's the first time we see it when Rebecca Romijn is running down the church steps.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we see that photo collage and we don't really know what it is yet. But keep going. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, totally. And so I'm just curious, like, if you notice any of these that I didn't catch, but there's a lot of these little touches.
If you remember all of the sort of billboards or you know, advertisements at the bus station and everything like that, they all say deja vu on them.
Mm.
Which is, and you see this maybe four or five times, and I think the picture of Rebecca Romijn might say deja vu on the bottom of it, of Anthony Banderas's, you know, snapshot of her that goes up around town. But you keep seeing that and it's like, okay, he's telling you the whole time that there's something dreamlike about this. This is deja vu. And you know, deja vu was also the original name of Obsession, of the Paul Schrader De Palma script.
Oh, interesting.
So there's always been this sort of, I think he's always wanted to make a movie about that. And as we'll see, you know, from the final 10 to 15 minutes of this movie, it's all deja vu. And it plays into that bartender who we see at the beginning and then we see at the end as this bartender, this kind of nondescript guy. And it's like, oh, I've seen him before. You get the feeling of deja vu.
Yeah. So we'll just get to that. So in retaliation, Lar executes Antonio Banderas and Bruce, and then her ex-accomplices show up and just kind of casually throw her off this bridge.
Yeah.
And then there's an extended twist ending that we find out the entirety of the film's events after Lar enters the tub in Lily's home are revealed to be a dream. Lar spies Lily entering the home as before, but this time stops her from committing suicide. Then Lily gets a ride with a guy who is, this is just a total aside, but the, I guess it's Lar. Somebody gets a ride with this guy who's driving a truck.
Yeah.
And did you notice that the way that guy was driving the truck was the worst movie driving ever? Like he's like
his hands are
are like totally constantly moving and like jostling. It's just there's the fakest looking. I don't know what to make it.
I have to go back and look, but I believe it. I totally believe it.
Anyway, 7 years later, Lar and Veronica, who is revealed to have been Lar's partner all along, chat about the success of their diamond caper. Black Tie and Racine arrive seeking revenge, but they are indirectly killed by the terrible driving truck driver guy who killed Veronica in Lar's dream. And this sequence, which again, the whole movie is absurd, but this sequence of the truck driver and the killing of the accomplices, there's so many little touches in it. It is so masterfully staged. And it's almost like it's like an elegy for De Palma's career, right? Which is if you watch De Palma movies, a lot of them are flawed, but within those flawed movies, there will usually be at least one, if not three or four, incredible, just unbelievably cinematically staged sequences. And this is one of them. There's all these little setups and payoffs and the light from the bauble that, that she gave to him for his daughter reflects in the truck driver's eyes. And that's what blinds him and makes him hit the guys who are next to this thing on the back of a truck that impales him. It's just, I think De Palma, is he the best ever at this sort of thing?
Yeah, I think that he is. I think it started with Hitchcock, and I think De Palma elevated it. This kind of cinematic language, this verbiage that De Palma sort of, just embellished. This one in particular, though, this particular sequence is great because it mirrors a sequence earlier in the film, right?
Yes.
It mirrors the same sequence, but different things happen. The first sequence, obviously, we find out is a dream. And we see this great setup of this sequence where, there's like that flower truck and they put the bed down and there are those sharp spikes that you think, or at least when I watch it in my head the first time, I say, oh, those are going to impale somebody, right? But then it doesn't, right? It's just the girl gets thrown out in front of the truck the first time. And it's like, oh shit, she's dead, right? But then when we do this again in real life, when we mirror it, then all this stuff pays off. The stuff with the light refracting in the chain that blinds the driver and then impales Black Tie and his accomplice. It's just it's so masterfully done. I mean, you think of other great De Palma set pieces, like obviously the Carlito's Way train sequence comes to mind. Yeah. The Carrie split screen pig blood prom sequence, and then the Mission Impossible one, of course.
The steps and Untouchables.
The steps and Untouchables, of course, man. I think that this one in particular just hits different because it's mirrored before in the film, but they're just I don't think there's anyone who could do it better than Brian De Palma.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps bringing me back to his movies. And
yeah.
Yes, they're implausible. The scripts are strange, but so is Vertigo. And so are these great Hitchcock movies. They, if you take them apart, they don't really make sense. There are all these things that you're taught not to do as a screenwriter, all this exposition, whatever. But you go back because you can just drink them in with your eyes. They're so visual and they're so well told visually. You can absorb it and live in it for 2 hours.
I think De Palma with a great script is better than most. Like if you have a great script and you have De Palma, that is like so exciting to me. I think Untouchables is such a great example of that with David Mamet, right? Untouchables is an extraordinary script. And if you gave that script to 20 directors, they would all probably make a good movie. But because it's De Palma made a great movie, and the skills that De Palma brings to it, like the step sequence and the Untouchables, elevates it even further. But it's all supported by like a good story, basically. Carlito's Way, pretty similarly.
Carlito's Way, David Kep, same thing, yeah. Right? But even De Palma writing Blowout is, to me, I think that's you know, maybe my favorite of his movies, or that, or Dressed to Kill, or you know, those are, you know, but Blowout sort of has the same thing where, you know, Blowout seems like this sort of weird, implausible setup, but it just works so well, mm-hmm. because it's so well executed. The performances are so good and the directing is just masterful. You know, that's a movie about a guy who's solving a crime by making a movie. And you do the same, and there's the same kind of thread here in Femme Fatale about this sort of meta movie watching theme that he has throughout most of his career.
Yeah,
I love it. I think that he does such a masterful job in this, and he's given sort of just carte blanche to go and do what he wants to do, and he never really got that chance again.
Yeah, I mean, this is really the De Palma movie for De Palma fans. So just to wrap it up, at the end, Bardo sees this whole thing happen with the guys getting killed, introduces himself to Lar, swearing that he has met her before, and she replies, "Only in my dreams," and that's the end of the movie. I thought we should do just like 30 seconds on Rebecca Romijn. So I read in the research that she kind of was reluctant to take the part. Obviously, there's a lot of nudity and sexuality, and she kind of was hoping that this would do for her what Basic Instinct did for Sharon Stone. And obviously, yeah, that didn't really end up happening. She has had a good career. She's definitely consistently worked as an actress. She's had some good runs on TV. She was Mystique in X-Men. Mm-hmm. But she's in a little bit of a tricky spot now. If you were like Rebecca Romijn's agent, like what should Rebecca Romijn do next? Like at the point that she's at now, because I definitely think that she is really a talented actress, and you know, this was very good in this part.
I don't know the answer. I don't have. I am not a good agent. You know, but she's great in this movie. I think that, you know, De Palma's, you know, has found, you know, great women, you know, as leads before. I mean, you think about Nancy Allen. You think about Body Double. I'm blanking. Melanie Griffith. You know, those are their first films, really. And this isn't Rebecca Romijn's first film, but she's good. She's very sexy. You know, but I think this probably got her. Was X-Men before this or after this? Didn't it, or the same year?
Maybe? I think they were pretty close.
They're pretty close, right? Yeah, I think X-Men was 01 and this is 02.
Yeah, I want to say that this came before X-Men. So it's possible that it had something to do with her.
Like Mystique is sort of a sexy character as well. And I think that she has that. She has that in her. I mean, I don't know. I mean, what would you put her in?
I think if I'm her agent, I'm trying to get her like a really cool pilot on HBO Max or Amazon that has some sort of a part that allows her to act and actually goes away from the sexy thing. Because, I mean, as an actress, you don't want to be locked into that every single time you got to play that. So I think that I would go the other way and try to find her a very character-y HBO Max or Amazon pilot. Maybe she's like, you know, the second lead or something, you know, that kind of thing. I think that that's, to me, if she could find a lane like that. I mean, I'm sure I, like everybody else, has been obsessed. You know, I just started watching The Mayor of Easttown. Have you seen that?
Oh my God.
Oh, good. Oh my
God. I'm so absorbed by that show. I have two episodes left.
I'm only 2.5 episodes in, and I'm like avoiding Twitter because I just don't want to know.
I think that show from minute one has been so astounding. I'm trying to think of the last time that I felt this way about a show, maybe Chernobyl. I really loved Chernobyl
Is almost the opposite of what we're talking about in this movie, which is something that is extremely well-written, extremely attention to detail, extremely plausible.
Extremely well-layered, you know. Yeah. I mean, I've loved it. I've loved every minute of it. I think that it's as good as dramatic cinematic storytelling gets.
Just as we wrap up here, so this movie, it's on Amazon Prime, I think, right? I think that's how we both watched it.
It is, yes. It's on Amazon Prime. It should be on until the end of the month, at least, when they.
So if you're like, this is a great Amazon Prime movie,
because it is. It is a great Amazon Prime
movie. It's not gonna cost you any money. Just
the it's set up strangely on Amazon Prime. I gotta say, I don't think that it's like a. It's definitely not like a 4K transfer. It's definitely an older print that they transferred, or maybe like a video print. And you have to watch it with subtitles because it's not subtitled. And there's a lot of French in the movie.
Right.
So turn the subtitles on.
Yeah. All right. That is our show for this week. If you want to keep up with the show, join our Facebook group at Movies I Love That No One Talks About, or follow me on Instagram at the same. If you dig the show, please leave me a 5-star review on iTunes. It's a huge help to the show. And if you're a monthly supporter of the show, feel free to request an episode at any time. I want to thank my guest, Joe Aliberti. Until next time, bye-bye.